From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The Democratic field of potential candidates for the 2020 presidential election is growing. Democratic primary voters will winnow that crowd down over the next 2 years, deciding what style of politician they think the country needs. A feisty progressive? A genial Uncle Joe with blue-collar street cred? Well, add one mild-mannered young Midwesterner to the list. Pete Buttigieg, the 37-year-old mayor of South Bend, Indiana. He's dipping his toe into the water. His pitch? It's a new era, and it's going to take a millennial to fix old problems that plague the country. This hour on Point, Mayor Pete Buttigieg and his eyes on the presidency. And you can join us. Have you heard of the mayor of South Bend, Indiana? Do you think he has what it takes to fill the Oval Office and pull this country together? And what about this idea that it's time for a new generation's big ideas to solve long-standing problems in the United States? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us today from Notre Dame, Indiana, is Pete Buttigieg. He's the two-term Democratic mayor of South Bend and now a presidential aspirant. He's got a new book out. It's called Shortest Way Home, One Mayor's Challenge and a Model for America's Future. We've got an excerpt of that at onpointradio.org. Mayor Buttigieg, welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you. Glad to be with you.
It's great to have you. You know, I read someone once referenced you as an old person's idea of a successful young person. Tell us a little bit about your story. How did you become the old person's idea of what a successful young American should be?
Well, I don't know exactly how to live into that. But I grew up here in South Bend. I grew up at a time when our city was really struggling. I think a lot of folks know that Notre Dame is here. What they may not realize is that we're really typical of a lot of communities in the industrial Midwest. We were a company town for Studebaker, which was a major auto producer until 1963 when it shut down. And even though I was born some 20 years after that happened, that experience still dominated the life of the city as I was growing up. There were vacant and abandoned houses, crumbling factory buildings, and I didn't even understand what that meant until I moved away and went to college at Harvard and began to realize that not every city had that. But the other thing I began to realize as I left home was that even though I had grown up kind of thinking that success meant getting away and going to a bigger city and going to the East Coast, I actually realized I was from somewhere and began feeling a tug toward home. It took me a while to get there, about 10 years, but I did, and making a very long story short, wound up as mayor of my hometown starting at the beginning of this decade. I was 29 when I ran. It was 2011, right around the time that Newsweek came to our city and published a story saying that we were one of America's 10 dying cities. And it triggered this deep and kind of anguished conversation about where our community was headed. But there were also a lot of people, especially my age, who believed in the city, believed that that it could be better, that we weren't dying, or at least we didn't have to be, and wanted to be part of that change. And that's really been the story of South Bend over the last decade, is how we've changed our trajectory.
Okay, so you're skillfully telling the story of South Bend there. But as you know, in politics, a lot of campaigning is telling the story about yourself and why you think you're the right person for the White House. I mean, yeah, you did make a long story short. That story includes Harvard University, a Rhodes Scholarship, time at Oxford, working at the consulting group McKinsey, learning Arabic in Tunisia, becoming mayor in 2011, serving in Afghanistan as a naval reservist in 2014, coming out as openly gay in 2015. And you're all doing this before you're 37, so we've got a lot of ground to cover here. Let me just go backwards a bit, because you talked about the Studebaker factory in South Bend and how the shuttering of the factory was truly devastating for South Bend. But your family, your parents never worked there, right? So tell me more about growing up.
Yeah, so like many families here, we were here because of Notre Dame. My father came to this country from the island of Malta. That's where he grew up. He told a story about a mentor who had promised him if he stayed in Malta, he could be a big fish in a small pond. And he replied that he would rather be a medium-sized fish in a very big pond, which is basically what happened. So he came to the U.S. for his education, got a PhD, became an American citizen, and met my mother when she she was also a faculty member teaching at New Mexico State University. I'm told the locals call it Sticker Bush State in Las Cruces. And they fell in love, and pretty soon after that got a job offer at Notre Dame. So they moved here. I don't think they expected to be here for that long, but as with a lot of people here, they found themselves to be lifers. So I grew up, really taking advantage of the livability of a community like this. Went to great schools, played in a park that was, in hindsight, pretty simple. There wasn't much to it. It just had a trash can and they mowed the grass. But it was, you could improvise with the way the trees were laid out to make it into a football field or a baseball diamond or a battlefield or whatever else you needed.
And when did you become first interested in public service?
Well, I think politics was always in the air in our household. My parents weren't politically connected or politically involved, but they were very politically conscious. And whenever, my parents' professor friends would come over and the talk at the dinner table was always about what was happening around the world. And I think I soaked up a sense of how important that was. I don't think it was till later that I realized that I might have a role in that. My big ambition when I was growing up was to be an astronaut, but my eyesight pretty much put an end to that ambition. But I guess by the end of high school, I ran for student council. I wound up as class president. I became more attuned to what leadership might mean. But even then, to the extent I ever thought about getting involved in politics, and especially once I got to Harvard and got steeped in the legend of JFK and all the things they teach there, I never would have guessed that local government and politics would be where I would really find a lot of purpose.
So I can't tell if the modesty I'm hearing now is genuine Midwestern modesty or what.
Nope, it's all fake.
No, because like in reading about your life, there's so many things to highlight. Like, okay, you said you wound up as student government or a president of your student government in high school, but as a senior, you also won in 2000 the JFK Profile in Courage essay contest, and your essay was about Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, obscure Vermont Congressman Bernie Sanders. So I like to, the hipster in me wants to say, I knew about that before it was cool.
Well, what was it about Sanders that in 2000, when you were in high school, attracted you to writing about him? Because I'm going to read a little excerpt here. You say, politicians are rushing for the center, careful not to stick their necks out on issues. Most Democrats shy away from the word liberal like a horrid accusation. Sanders' courage is evident in the first word he uses to describe himself, socialist. You wrote that as a high school student.
Yeah, kind of sounds like it was written by a high school student, doesn't it? But, I there was something that struck me about the fact that he just said what he was. And, agree or disagree, it felt just there was a kind of cleanliness to that at a moment when it seemed like actually at the time, this isn't really true anymore, but at the time it seemed to me that both parties were doing whatever they could to paper over their conviction and just get into this kind of middle ground that would be the most palatable. It turned out to be very wrong, those of us who thought that there was very little ideological difference between, for example, Al Gore and George W. Bush. But what was right was that I think there was this moment where people were reluctant to say what they were really about because it didn't seem politically useful. And here you have this guy come along, says exactly what he is. He uses a word that is typically a kill switch or a political death sentence, right? Nobody wanted to be called socialist, and even a whiff of socialism was a good way to kill off debate around an idea, whether it was a good idea or not. And interestingly also, he was actually more effective at working with Republicans than some fellow Democrats, I think because, he was just focused on ideas and what you could do and would work across the aisle when he could.
Hmm. And so that sort of frankness and boldness, do you see more room for that now in national American politics?
I think so. I think people are looking for conviction. I think people are looking for authenticity. And there are a lot of different kind of ways to deliver that. But I think more and more, especially in a younger generation that can just detect insincerity and posturing from a mile away. We grew up on very sophisticated TV and digital advertising, and we just know when something's being served up to us that isn't real, which means I think we have an expectation that's classically millennial but also classically Midwestern. So part of it may be just where I come from, that you ought to just mean what you say.
And so when you're talking to voters, what are you saying that you most deeply mean when you're communicating with them?
Well, I talk a lot about freedom, democracy, and security. That's our framework. And look, at first blush, that sounds like any number of general buzzwords that don't mean much because they're not things you can be against. But when I unpack them, they lead to some commitments that that might be controversial, but I think are important. On freedom, I think it's really important for Democrats and progressives to get back in the business of talking about freedom, because I think we yielded that ground to conservatives and libertarians who were very sensitive to freedom. Right? They talk a lot about freedom from government, freedom from regulation, freedom from taxes. And yet, in my experience, what's mattered most has been freedom too. And I think it's actually progressive policies that help secure those freedoms, whether it's freedom to be able to go off and start a small business because your health care has been taken care of. It's not strictly dependent on an employer. Or freedom to organize into a labor union, or freedom to, one freedom that's been very important in my life, of course, is the freedom to marry the person you actually love. So I think when we really dig into what freedom means and those kind of positive, proactive freedoms that I think help decide whether we get to live a life of our choosing, it turns out that good government can help secure those freedoms just as much as bad government can impair them. Mm. Democracy is also something I think we need to be talking about more. I think it's not an accident that our party is named after democratic commitments and democratic tendencies. I think when we talk about security, we on our side of the aisle have, I think, more interest in the 21st century forms of security,
yeah.
Climate security,
well,
election security.
Let's take a quick break here, and we'll talk more about sort of your vision for the future when we come back. We're talking this hour with Mayor Pete Buttigieg. He is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and a Democratic presidential hopeful as well. We'll take a quick break here with some music from Robbie Foulkes. This is a song called South Bend Soldiers On. This is On Point.
His eyes would surely swim to see this place where so much is the same. One God assures our freedom, two armies keep control. The U.S. for the young ones, salvation for the weak and old. Keep your burden from your neighbor, leave a good name when you're gone. People last but a lifetime in South Bend, soldiers on.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Mayor Pete Buttigieg. He is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and he's also a 2020 Democratic presidential hopeful. He has a new book out called Shortest Way Home, One Mayor's Challenge and a Model for America's Future. So Mayor Buttigieg, let me just ask you quickly, do you remember, you've actually been on Point before. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I don't think it was even called On Point back then. But it's funny you should mention that. I was just reflecting on the way over, wondering about whether that would come up. I was on with, I think I was a junior, and I went on with a fellow student, maybe a sophomore, who's now a Republican member of Congress, Elise Stefanik. And we were on to talk about the results of a piece of research we were involved in on young people and their political attitudes.
Yeah. It was 2001, just after 9/11. And you're right, the program was called Special Coverage at that time. Mm. But we just wanted to give you a blast from the past because here's this exact moment where Pete Buttigieg, then a Harvard student, you'll hear his political passion and maybe political acumen here from 18 years ago now.
We've been really surprised, pleasantly surprised, at the jump in trust and confidence in government that we've seen since the last time we measured college students last spring. We found that the number has almost doubled for trust in the federal government, from 36% in 2000 to 60% now. It's still unclear whether that's going to be a sort of spike associated with the events of September 11th, but we're hoping that in the future we'll be able to draw out the survey and see if this holds long term.
That's Mayor Pete Buttigieg back when he was a Harvard student in 2001. What do you think?
From the archives. Unfortunately, it turned out it was a spike related to 9/11, and confidence in our institutions among young people started eroding, I think, pretty soon after that. that is memory lane there.
So you know what I hear in that? I hear in that a young, very bright, ambitious, politically astute college student who's very focused on policy and information. How have you, you know, through being mayor of South Bend, through your, you know, multiple life experiences since then, how have you evolved as a political creature since then? Are policies sort of information and wonkery, for lack of a better term, still sort of the center of who you are as an American politician?
Well, I think I'm still a policy guy, but I've definitely been through a couple of evolutions. One of them I write about in the book, which is that, you know, I arrived, you know, that tendency toward policies and facts and data and numbers only got more kind of heightened by my studies and then my time as a consultant. So when I arrived as mayor, I really was extremely focused on performance management and making sure that we, you know, we set up a 311 center, partly to make customer service easier, but also partly because I wanted the data to see where we were doing well, where we were doing poorly, and, you know, hundreds of thousands of calls that we could use to really set up metrics to see how we could do a better job. But the longer I was mayor, the more I began to realize that the other side of the job, the symbolic side of the job, just setting the tone and being a kind of walking symbol or avatar of the life of the city, mm-hmm. was actually really important. It actually had its own substance. And it took me a while to grow into that or even to admit it. The first time I really came to understand it was a very painful moment. We were on the scene of a homicide. And I encountered the mother of the victim of a young victim of gun violence. And my brain went to, okay, what do you do? How do you comfort somebody in this situation? I don't have any psychological training. What's the, you know, what's the protocol? What are the words that will help this person? And what I realized very quickly was it had nothing to do with my skill level. It had nothing to do with any expertise in counseling, which I obviously did not have. I learned over time that encounter I had with her was a comfort to her, but it almost had nothing to do with me personally at all. Mm-hmm. It was that my being there meant the mayor was there, that meant the city was there, and that meant the city cared about her loss.
Yeah.
And so whether it was painful moments like that or some really enjoyable moments like this massive party that we threw for the city on its 150th anniversary, exactly the side of the job that I would have hated when I was just getting into it, it wound up being really important because that was a way to both test and assert that the city really was coming back.
Yeah. So, you know, there's no office in the land more suited isn't the right word, that there's no office in the land that Americans pour more of their hopes and dreams into than the presidency of the United States. Mm. And so I'm really intrigued to hear you say that, you know, you had this learning process about, you know, being a political leader also means being, as you just said, a walking symbol or an avatar. So, I mean, you and your life story contains a lot of that symbolism. I'm specifically thinking about how you came out in 2015, right? About, you know, being a gay man in America. And in fact, this is something now that you invoke on the campaign trail. I was reading that with some caucus goers in Iowa very recently. You said, "My marriage is the most important thing in my life. It exists by the grace of a single vote on the United States Supreme Court. It is one of the reasons why I feel so intimately why politics matters." But Mayor Buttigieg, my question for you is, you came out in 2015, you had already been elected to one term as mayor of South Bend. Did you think you waited too long to come out?
I don't know. That's a pretty deep question. I think you're ready when you're ready. And it took me a long time to get ready. I had begun the process just talking to a couple of very close. First of all, it took the better part of my 20s to even come out to myself. Mm-hmm. Once I got there, I knew when I was about to take office that I was, you know, I was about to take on an office with a lot of responsibility, and I needed to at least have my kind of self in my head clear enough that I came out to a couple of very close friends. and kind of launch the process. But I had no clue how to do that to the rest of the world, how to do it publicly, what it would do to my career. At the time, I was also in the reserve under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. You know, in a way, I'm not sure I ever would have got around to it if it weren't for the deployment. But something about the deployment kind of focused my awareness of the fact that you only get to live one life. And even though there was no convenient moment or sort of suitable moment to do this, I realized that I wasn't getting any younger. And I also just wanted to have a personal life. You know, there's no real way to have a love life as a closeted mayor in a place like South Bend, or if there is, it certainly was not obvious to me how to do it. And so if I wanted to start dating, I had to get this out of the way. And so it was actually a very personal reason to do something that wound up being this very public thing, which had political implications, but was mostly motivated by my need just to get on with my life.
Yeah. Well, I read the op-ed that you wrote in the South Bend Tribune in 2015, you know, coming out to your constituents and you know, the world. And you said, it's clear to me that at a moment like this, you know, referring to the Supreme Court cases about same-sex marriage, that being more open about it could do some good. For a local student struggling with her sexuality, it might be helpful for an openly gay mayor to send the message that her community will always have a place for her. And for a conservative resident from a different generation whose unease with social change is partly rooted in the impression that he doesn't know anyone gay, perhaps a familiar face can be a reminder that we're all in this together as a community. That's what you wrote in 2015. So do you see yourself as a bridge?
Maybe. I think, you know, one thing I noticed after I came out was there were some people who I knew who were older, who were more conservative, who made a point of saying something when they ran into me encouraging or affirming. May or may not have had anything directly to do with coming out. They might have just reached out in some way. But I could tell that as they showed themselves to be more accepting, they also felt better about themselves. And I thought that was a really important thing to watch because I don't know what it's like to be you know, to grow up, let's say you go through 60 or 70 years of being led to believe something is morally wrong. And then within a few years, the kind of balance of public opinion is telling you there's something wrong with you if you're not on board. you know, that must be really disorienting. And I tried to make sure I moved with some understanding of that mindset, because the last thing I wanted us to do, especially because this was also the kind of time when there was a huge fight in Indiana over then Governor Mike Pence's so-called religious freedom bill, I wanted to make sure we didn't do anything that would alienate and push people right into the arms of the religious right when they were just beginning to show that they were able to grow and to kind of be beckoned onto the right side of history. And then on the other end of the spectrum, it was really moving how many people I heard from, just emails and notes that came in or people who approached me who basically said, I am that high school kid you were writing about. Mm-hmm. You know, it means a lot to me to see you and to know that you're there.
But let me ask you, though, I think you're spot on about the disorienting nature of rapid social change. And, you know, I suppose people can take issue with a certain criticism that was levied at Democrats in the last presidential election. But, you know, you probably read them. There were all those op-eds saying that Hillary Clinton embraced identity politics too much. Is that a criticism that you'd share of the Democratic Party?
I think the problem arises when we're speaking to each identity group in a completely different vocabulary than the others. And I think there was a temptation, not just on the part of one candidate, but really as an organizing style in the Democratic Party. You know, it starts off with something that's correct, which is the insight that, you know, there are better ways than others of reaching communities of interest. There's there are ways of reaching black voters that are different than where you're going to find most of your Latinx voters and so on. But the message, the thrust, the values really need to be consistent. One thing you learn as a mayor very quickly is never to say anything in one group that you would be embarrassed to have repeated to another.
Uh-huh.
And I think at the national level, we started assembling this kind of patchwork of stories, a different story for each identity group. And it made it harder to sift through that and understand what we were fundamentally about, when actually we have a lot of commitments around freedom, like I was talking about before. Fairness is another way to look at it. You know, I think the way we think about fairness, kind of knits together things like the way we feel about workers' rights to organize, which is viewed as an issue that is important to all working class voters, including white working class voters, and our commitment to racial justice and the implications that has for our views on voting rights.
Mayor Buttigieg, I'm going to go to the phones here in just a second, but I do have one kind of very superficial question, but I'm really curious to ask. You got married, what, 8-9 months ago?
Yeah, it was in June.
Okay. So you get married, love of your life, and then you turn around and you tell your husband, hey, how about I run for president? How'd you make that decision, and how did your husband take it?
So, first of all, we make decisions together, and Chasten did get a lot more than he bargained for. We I was already mayor when we started dating, and so he sort of knew what he was getting into. But it took a while for both of us, a lot of growing pains, figuring out how to be a very visible couple. That I think doesn't matter if you're gay or not; it's just a hard thing to figure out when you're the first couple of a city. And I had frankly gotten bachelor mayor life down pretty pat. So both of us were making an adjustment. But he reminds me that on our first date, he asked about the future. And I told, what at the time was an honest answer, which was, I'm up for re-election this year. If it goes well and I have two successful terms as mayor, then there's a pretty good chance in 2020 that I might be in a position to run statewide, maybe even run for governor. This is obviously different. Having an exploratory committee for a presidential campaign in 2020 is different than what any of us would have guessed. But he's supportive. He believes in me. I think he sees not only the historic nature of our marriage being part of this conversation, but also just our shared values, and wants to be a part of that. And he's he's the kind of spouse who wants to be there in the mix. He has a great way with people and a great touch, and I think he's made me a better mayor and a better candidate.
Well, I'm speaking with Mayor Pete Buttigieg. He is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. He has a new book out called Shortest Way Home, One Mayor's Challenge and a Model for America's Future. And he is exploring a run for president of the United States as well. Let's go to Vicky, who's calling from Oberlin, Ohio. Vicky, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I live in a college town like you, Mr. Mayor, and so I'm surrounded by young people all the time. Right. I was taken especially by what you were saying about freedom from versus freedom to, and how you obviously take to heart the experiences of individuals. And I think you could be successful if we can get the younger people actively involved in the primary season and then the general election. So my question for you, Mr. Mayor, is, what are your ideas for bringing younger, first-time, apathetic voters to the polls?
It's such a great question, and it's so important. It's one of the things we studied in that study that Teenage Pete was making his radio debut talking about some 20 years ago. Why is it that young people who clearly care about the world around them don't show up and vote? So there are some short-term tactical answers that we'll be engaged in a lot that have to do with making sure we use different media. We're doing everything from old-fashioned living room meet and greets to trying to have a really strong Instagram presence and everything in between. We're going to be visiting a lot of colleges and communicating with young people about the stakes, especially for this young generation. I mean, the younger you are, the longer you're planning to be here. Almost by definition, the more you have at stake in issues like climate change and others that are on the table right now. But the deeper, actually, answer to that question, I think, is young people aren't completely wrong when they believe the political system is something they should be skeptical of, because it's gotten less and less democratic. And so I think if we really want to have more voter participation in a more democratic society for young people and for all people, not only do we have to take measures to simply make it easier to vote, like Election Day being a holiday or taking place on a weekend, but also things to make elections matter more. If you're in Indiana, no matter what age you are, most of the time our votes barely even matter because it's so rare for us to be a swing state because of the Electoral College. When most Americans live in districts that have been drawn to where politicians are choosing their voters rather than the other way around, even though I'm passionately believe that everybody should vote, you understand why somebody might draw the conclusion that they shouldn't bother. And so it's not just a question about what's wrong with young people that they're not participating. It's what's wrong with politics that young people who do care don't see what it has to offer them.
But you're not running, or when you've officially announced, you're not going to be running as the millennial candidate, right? So how do you accomplish all that you just said without alienating the people who do overwhelmingly go to the polls, you know, senior voters?
You know, when I was running for mayor, we had enough money to do one poll, and we pulled some of my attributes, and one of them was the fact that I was 29 years old. And when the numbers came back, there was a straight line correlation that the older the voter was, the more likely they were to say that was a positive. I still don't know all the features behind that, but what it tells me is that this isn't about young candidates for young voters. This is about building an alliance between generations who believe in making sure that the next generation is better off.
Well, Mayor Pete Buttigieg, stand by here for just a moment. Mayor Buttigieg is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. He's also considering a run for president of the United States. We'll be back with a lot more. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Mayor Pete Buttigieg. He's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. He has a new book out. It's called Shortest Way Home, One Mayor's Challenge and a Model for America's Future. And Mayor Buttigieg is also considering a run for the White House. He's 37 years old. And, you know, you could make the argument that age doesn't really factor into this presidential race already. The pool of Democratic presidential hopefuls already includes Julian Castro, 44-year-old former San Antonio mayor, and Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, for example. She's a 37-year-old representative from Hawaii. And just as a little historical reminder, John F. Kennedy was 43 when he was elected to the White House, but he had also served in Congress. So Mayor Buttigieg, we've got a comment here coming in on along these lines. Ellie Peterson says, if elected, I believe he, being you, would be the only the second ever president to go from mayor to president. And I find it unlikely as much as I like what he has to say. What's your response to Ellie?
I'd say this is a season for unlikely outcomes. We just had the first reality TV show star to go direct to the presidency, and I'm not saying we want to emulate that. And by the way, I also don't believe all the old rules are gone. But I do believe it's a moment to be a little more open about what prepares you for that office. I get that a more traditional route would be to go through Congress. I'm also a little skeptical that Congress right now is the best preparation for that executive office. You know, when you're a mayor, you're especially in a strong mayor system like we have here in South Bend, you are on the front line of executive leadership. One minute you're dealing with a controversy over a municipal golf course, and then a phone call comes in and a plane has crashed into a neighborhood, or you need to activate the emergency operations center due to a flood, or there's an officer involved shooting with a lot of racial sensitivity. And the next minute you're back to or the next day you're back to working on an economic development deal. You know, you are dealing with so many things that range from policy minutiae to just holding a community together that I can't think of something that's more relevant. I don't mean to be disrespectful of Congress, but a member of Congress, your main job is to vote on things. Your job is to form good opinions.
Can I just jump in here, Mr. Mayor, for a second? Because I think, I mean, like recent history has shown that you're exactly right. Americans, with the exception of Barack Obama, haven't picked a senator or representative as president for some time. It's looked to governors. So for that same sort of executive leadership, so why not the governorship of Indiana as a next step?
Well, I don't believe in running for an office so that you can run for some other office. As I shared earlier, there was a moment when I was really interested in statewide office here in Indiana. But any discernment process about running for any office, I think, is looking at what the office calls for, looking at the moment, what's needed, and then looking at what you bring to the table and then seeing if that's a match. And I've used that discernment process in decisions to run for office before, and I've used it in decisions not to run for office before. Governors are also have that very highly relevant executive leadership. There are comparatively few Democratic governors right now. There are some impressive ones. I think one virtue of being mayor is that you're really on the ground in a way that also connects you to the experience and the vocabulary of voters, for the simple reason that I also have a lifestyle that is comparatively normal, as people in this political conversation go, live in a middle-class neighborhood in the industrial Midwest. And if I really want to know what's going on in middle America, there doesn't have to be a listening tour. I can just go to Target and people will tell me in a hurry.
Well, let's go to Hedge, who's calling from Idaho Falls, Idaho. Hedge, you're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Mayor Pete. We were residents of South Bend from 1996 to 2006, and my mother was a resident of South Bend when you were first elected, and she is a huge fan of yours. She's now 89 years old.
And that's great. Tell her hi for me,
please.
You're
the best mayor. I will. She thinks you're the best mayor that South Bend's ever had, and that the changes that you've helped to make were very positive. You are also part of the same graduating class of Notre Dame that our youngest daughter was, and I value that education factor. We moved to England in 1996 and moved back to the United States in 2017, seriously considering not moving back to the United States simply because of the political climate. I agree with you that it is something that a younger person needs to embrace and help to make changes that otherwise are not going to be made. They're going to continue status quo. Well, I'm a big fan of yours. I consider myself a Hoosier. And
we'll keep claiming it no matter where you are.
President.
Hedge, thank you so much for your call. Mayor Buttigieg, let me just move forward to one aspect that you've talked about a little bit on the campaign trail. And it's language I hadn't heard used before, that you're thinking about what you call intergenerational justice, right, as a primary motivator for you to want to seek higher office. So when you say intergenerational justice, what do you mean?
Well, what I mean is how committed are we to making sure that the world really will be better in practical terms for the way we live in the future? I think a lot about the year 2054. It's, God willing, when I will reach the current age of the current president. And so many of the things that are being talked about or done right now, or not done in the case of climate, but also some of the choices around tax cuts for the very wealthy, for example, I think because some of the most severe consequences of those, according to projections, happen maybe 10 or 15 years out, there are a lot of people in positions of responsibility in Washington who regard it as somebody else's problem. I regard it as my problem, not just as someone in politics, but as a human being. And so I think we need to talk about how each generation prepares a better world for the next. And again, this doesn't have to be a matter of generational conflict. On the contrary, I think that people in aging generations are especially passionate about making sure that life is better in the future. But I belong to a generation that is on course statistically, potentially, to be the first ever in American history to be worse off economically, maybe even to see life expectancies decline compared to the generation before. I don't think anybody wants that, not my generation or the generation above us. And yet those in power today in Washington seem to continue to make choices that would make that worse.
So let me just jump in here because, yes, I can hear what you're saying around issues of climate, taxes, foreign policy and war. But, you know, there is some evidence. I've seen some research that shows that, for example, many people who voted for Donald Trump, for President Trump, were also motivated by exactly what you're talking about. They were concerned about the future for their children. And they channeled that concern through, sort of the nativist policies that the president and then candidate Trump was talking about on the campaign trail. So the same motivation, but a whole different set of policies that they felt was the right choices to help maintain or give hope to their kids and grandkids. How do you speak to them?
Well, I think he made a promise to turn back the clock. And that is a promise that just fundamentally can't be kept. It's appealing in the moment sometimes, especially when, as our community is here in the industrial Midwest, when you're grappling with loss. But I don't think an honest politics could ever revolve around the word again. When I was running for mayor, we had a lot of conversations about how nothing resembling Studebaker was ever coming back, but we were, and here was how. And then we talked about an economy that mixed our manufacturing strengths with industries that hadn't existed when the last Studebaker rolled off the line. The hard truth is it's easier through political rhetoric and political behavior to arouse the worst in us, to make us more resentful, to make us more fearful, than it is to use politics to make us better, to make us more at ease and generous and open-minded. But it can be done. And I think that's what leadership is really made of. Now, I will say, out of regard for many people who, especially in my area, went to the ballot box, voted for this president, they were under no illusions about his character. But they were essentially voting to burn the house down because the system had let them down. And I think one of our failures in the Democratic Party when it came to the political system and the economic system was we allowed ourselves to be in the position of being defenders of the system, the ones who said, no, the system's doing just fine. And that was not convincing because so many people have been let down by the way things were, not just in the last couple years, but in the last 30 or 40.
Mm. Well, let's go to Byron, who's calling from New Orleans, and let's talk about some specific policies or specific ideas. So, Byron, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. Thank you for taking my call. And hi, Mayor Buttigieg. I'd like to preface this by saying that as a gay person enamored by politics, it's really inspiring to see you in the race.
Thank you.
My question is, do you support Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal? Do you support single-payer Medicare for all? Do you support a living wage tied to inflation? And do you support ending our illegal and unnecessary wars overseas? And will you swear off corporate PAC money? And will you swear off big money bundling so that I can believe you if you say that you are in support of those things?
Well, Byron, thank you for your call. Mayor Buttigieg, we can go through this list. Let's start with the Green New Deal. What do you think?
All right. Yeah, I wrote them down on a napkin here, so I'm going to try to make sure I get to all of them. Yeah. So first of all, I think it's really meaningful that the domestic policy debate has largely been kicked off by a member of Congress who's even younger than I am. And I think she's on the right track with the goals of the Green New Deal. So I consider myself a supporter. We do need to say that the Green New Deal in its current form is more a set of goals than it is a fully articulated set of plans and policies. I think that's okay. I think our debate right now needs to – one of the great things about this conversation is it reminds us of the level of ambition that our policy debates ought to have. We shouldn't negotiate with ourselves on the front end. We should set out bold, aggressive, ambitious goals that treat climate like the emergency that it is, and in the case of the Green New Deal, it also viewed as an opportunity to create more economic well-being and justice. And so I think we need to keep developing that, and I do consider myself a supporter. Medicare for all, same thing. I'm a supporter. I believe, for some family reasons, I've come to appreciate just how much of a huge difference maker Medicare itself is. And when I look at the citizens of so many developed countries, most of them, who enjoy some version of universal health care and we don't, I think it's really problematic. I also would point out.
Can I just jump in here for a second? Because Byron asked specifically regarding a single payer model.
Yes. No, I favor that. Now, okay. I also think that, just as Medicare has things like Medicare Advantage, if we have a single public payer for your kind of central health care needs, it's still possible that there may be some kind of supplemental role that the private sector can pay. But fundamentally, I think that's the direction we need to move in. My view of how we get there is to put some version of Medicare out on the exchanges, because if people like me are right, it will be the preferred option for everybody and people will buy into it at an increasing mm-hmm. rate. Until it becomes the single payer.
Right. I just have to jump in here for a second and say, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Apologies, Mayor Buttigieg. I just had to do that for specific reasons. But go
living
ahead.
Wage, big fan, was prevented by Indiana law from doing that here in South Bend. So we just tried to lead by example and boost the wages of city employees, as well as implementing paid family leave. Since we're a big employer ourselves, we hope that other employers would take note and follow our lead. When it comes to war, as somebody who was sent into war on the orders of a president, I know very much why we need to think hard before ever engaging in another conflict. And I think we need to put an end to endless war. Look, we have people who are now almost old enough to be deployed to Afghanistan who were not even alive for 9/11. And we've got people operating in places all over the world on an authorization for the use of military force that's nearly 18 years old. That's the abdication of war powers by the Congress is a problem. And when you see saber rattling, you know, the latest is Venezuela. I mean, proposing that we might be sending troops to Venezuela, I think just takes us so far away from the idea that the commitment of American troops in armed conflict is a last resort that should only be done to protect core American interests aligned with American values. And yes, I've made the decision not to accept corporate PAC money as well.
So, listeners, make note that if you give Mayor Pete Buttigieg a bullet list of questions, he's going to answer them all. You know, Mayor, we've got about a couple of minutes left, 2 or 3 minutes left here. And I want to ask you, you know, I started the hour way long ago by saying, you know, you've got these big ideas that are, in a sense, very emblematic of how many millennial Americans feel, including things like maybe abolishing the Electoral College, which, of course, would have to come through, you know, constitutional amendments. Mm-hmm. But sure. I'm wondering, you know, whether or not there may be a time as you proceed through your ambitions for the presidency that you run up against the willingness of the Democratic Party as a whole to embrace those big ideas. Maybe that's not so much of a big deal after the 2018 elections here, but are those sort of world-changing, table-overturning ideas, is the party itself willing to embrace it, or do they worry that if you're out there on the campaign trail saying abolish the Electoral College, Green New Deal, you know, universal health care and college for all, that that's going to render a candidate unelectable?
You know, I think we as a party have managed to psych ourselves out time and time again by overthinking how to reach others. I enjoyed a lot of Republican support as mayor. It was never by pretending to be more conservative than I am. It was by being clear about my values so that if somebody – and clear about results. So even if somebody had somewhat different values, they knew that I came by my values honestly, and they knew that I would work to deliver results that we all cared about. I think it's the same at the national level. And you know, the truth is a lot of these so-called left ideas are common sense ideas that most Americans are already on board with. So we can tie ourselves in knots worrying about what America is ready for. But as a party, I think we should just put forward, at risk of sounding a bit naive, I think we should just talk about doing what we think is right, work on convincing people, and let the politics go from there. I actually think conservatives, beginning with Barry Goldwater, I don't agree with them, but they began doing that. And it was only when they stopped being afraid to talk about what they believed in, even though it was sometimes outside of the mainstream back then, that they pulled the entire American political system to the right, to where today a position like, well, let's take Medicare for All, a compromise position between the far left, which is publicly owned healthcare, and a public provider, and the far right, which is all corporate free market. You have this compromise position, which is private provider, public payer. Mm-hmm. And that's regarded as left wing, even though most Americans get it.
Yeah. So we have 30 seconds left. One last question. You learned Arabic in Tunisia. And is it also true that in order to read a novel, you taught yourself Norwegian?
Yeah, both are a little rusty now, but I'll tell you, Norwegian for an English speaker is an awful lot easier than Arabic.
Well, Mayor Pete Buttigieg, he's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. He has a new book out called Shortest Way Home, One Mayor's Challenge and a Model for America's Future. And he is considering a run for president of the United States. Mayor Buttigieg, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
Well, folks, before we wrap up, I want to remind you that you can subscribe to the On Point newsletter right on our homepage, onpointradio.org. There you'll find messages from me and my colleague David Folkenflik, surveys, and other opportunities to really interact with us and the program as a whole, a selection of our favorite stories of the week, and more. So that's the newsletter. Go to onpointradio.org to subscribe. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.